Okay. Well, at the time of the Tet Offensive, I was the Director of Information at the Embassy of Vietnam here in Washington. And with that vantage point, I had the opportunity to see the Tet Offensive as reported on the one side by the press telex like UPI, AP, Reuters, AFP, and then on the other side, the telex, the internal telex that we had that has a direct link back to the embassy, to the foreign ministry in Saigon and the presidential palace in Saigon. And so you can see that those two types of stories, you know, flashing at you and coming in parallelly. On the one hand, you have a lot of stories that are sounds panic-stricken, that are concentrated in particular on one major event, which was the attack on the American embassy. On the other hand, you have a comprehensive story, one that covers all the attacks around the country. And what we could see was that there was a reaction time in the case of the Vietnamese army and authorities back in Vietnam. I think within 24 hours, we knew exactly what there was to do. The troops are back in their camps and fighting. And after 48 hours, the whole thing becomes very clear. That is, the communists have been thrown out of the major point of attacks. And there's only a couple of cities where there was still fighting going on. The most celebrated case was obviously the case of Hue, in which there was a massacre later on. But in essence, the story of the Tet Offensive was that the communists went through what they call a suicidal type of attack, which make a big splash in the news. And those news influenced very much the American public. Corroborated the details of quagmires and whatnot that was fostered by the American press that started, I'd say, at least back in 1967 with the Newsweek cover articles called The Alliance and Our Rabbits. So after that, people tend to dismiss the South Vietnamese army as something very ineffectual. In actuality, you could say that the Tet Offensive was essentially taken care of by the Vietnamese army and also by the field police, which gave a very good accounting of themselves in the Saigon Chalon area. The I'd say that there's
why
no.
Why don't you stop for a moment here?
Okay.
Why don't we focus now in terms of Quebec? While I was working in the South Vietnamese embassy in Washington.
Yes.
During the Tet, and then focus on that booklet.
Okay.
That you produced, and then why it was needed.
Yes.
And say something about the attitude of the American public as a result of the
yes.
other information they were getting.
Yes. Okay. Now, you know, as soon as the situation sort of clear itself, which is only about 3 days afterwards, as the director of information, I had to put out a booklet, which was done in a rush. Because I remember that very well. I had to stay stay in the embassy at night, late until night, to type that out. And we didn't have time to have it typeset or anything like that. I remember even the cover, I had to do it by hand, just in order to send out something to our regular mailing list, which was about 12,000 across the country, to tell them what the actual situation was, because you have to counteract that what I referred to earlier as a kind of panic-stricken type of reports that you get from the press at the time.
Okay, and now maybe in this anecdote about appearing in a Milwaukee radio show
yes.
and stressing the difficulty of communicating your understanding what the Tet Offensive meant versus the people calling in
yes.
what they thought it was because they had
yes.
access only to the public press.
Yes. Now, I think the story, the booklet, was interesting in the sense that it's now in the Library of Congress for anyone who would want to check it. So that, you know, it's not a story that we handed out later to people. Following a couple of weeks after the Tet Offensive started in Saigon, I had a chance to go and speak on a radio show in Milwaukee, I remember. Of course, there's all kind of questions and people calling in, and they were quite, they didn't quite trust my story. And so, in fact, they haven't come out and said it, but more or less they are saying that, you know, I'm telling them a tale. And so I could see that immediately that here you have a big problem, the perceptions. The one that we had, based on real internal information, that in other words, make it clear that the Tet Offensive was a total military failure of the other side. In fact, one way to check on that is that after 1968, you didn't hear anymore about the so-called NNF units in Vietnam. All the fighting after Tet was done by North Vietnamese units. And so despite the fact that I had that information with me, it took some time to really convince people, whether in colleges or in a situation of a radio audience like that, that the real story is quite different from what they have been fed in the daily press. Yes.
Okay, let's go back and in a very short way, if we could summarize, you know, start again with I was working in the U.S., in the South Vietnamese Embassy in Washington, in a very short way, dramatize this difference between official information and the wire services, and try to do it in a very concentrated manner.
Tight. Okay. Well, at the time of the Tet Offensive, I was the Director of Information at the Embassy of Vietnam here in Washington. And because of that, the function of mine, I had a very good vantage point from which I could see, on the one side, the press stories as reflected in the telex coming across in UPI, AP, Reuters, AFP. On the other hand, the story that we get from the inside information from our own internal telex that has a direct link with the presidential palace in Saigon and the foreign ministry in Saigon. So you have these two stories side by side that's coming at you 24 hours a day, and you can see this huge disparity between them. On the one hand, is that essentially the South Vietnamese army, you know, despite the Tet truce and all this kind of thing, you know, took hold of the situation within 24 hours. The illustration is the Vice President Ki, who was then vacationing in Dalat. Immediately, he took the first plane, flew back to Saigon. There's no desertions. Everybody, you know, immediately joined their camps in order to fight. So that within 48 hours, the situation was under control, with the exception of maybe two places in the whole country. One of that being Binh Tre and the other being Hue. And yet, on the other hand, you have this series of tales and which sounds very much panicky. And I guess it has to do partly with the inexperiences of the foreign press at the time in Saigon. They were used to hearing about battles way out of Saigon. All of a sudden, it's right next door, it's outside your hotel, and so on and so forth. And these people have never had that experience and, of course, reacted in very much of a panicky way.
Okay, let's go, while we're on this, could you say something about the embassy incident and how it was blown out of proportion as a story, the attack on the U.S. embassy?
Well, the attack on the U.S. embassy was clearly in a mold of a typical communist so-called suicidal attack. The suicidal attack is one in which you sacrifice a couple of people who accept to sacrifice themselves in order to make a big splash in the news. And of all the places, if you are an American viewer here in the United States, and all the places you would think that the most well-defended place has to be the embassy, the American embassy in Saigon. Well, that's first is a misperception, because Saigon saw very little fighting during the whole war. So that the American embassy, while it was guarded, was not anything like any fortress or anything like that. Anyone who is crazy enough to drive a car into the embassy gates could easily do that at any time of the day. It's a little bit like sometime that happens to the White House here. Maybe a crazy person can do that. Now, if you take it as the action of a crazy person, then you give very little thought to it. But if you think that, see how vulnerable the White House is or how vulnerable the embassy is, then you think That is, this is about the most daring attack that tells of an enemy which is all-powerful and which is omnipresent everywhere. They can attack at will, which was not at all the case. And yet, this is the one story during the whole Tet Offensive that received massive coverage in American press. And that makes it that the American public turned in their opinion about the Vietnam War, that made Walter Cronkite revise his view, that eventually even made President Johnson refuse to run nomination of the Democratic Party to run again as president. So that's, that shows the importance of the press, what they can do about a very small incident to turn.
Mentioning the embassy incident, could you say something about the inexperience of the press and the fact that the war basically came to the door of their hotel? I mean,
yes.
That's what was happening at
yes.
the embassy.
Yes.
Could you say something? Well, the embassy incident is a case in which the war came to the reporters or something like that.
Yes.
Talk
yeah.
about their inexperience.
Yes. Okay, the embassy incident, among others, shows how vulnerable the American press could be to the type of suicidal attack for which the communists are very well known. They know that they need to sacrifice a couple of people, but they know that they're going to have also a very big splash, the news front page cover story and so on and so forth. And because the American press has never been exposed to that type of tactics, so when it happens on the embassy steps or right in front of their hotels, the Continental Palace and so on and so forth in Saigon, then they see that as by far the biggest story. They concentrate on that because it's right in front of their eyes, and forget about the broader picture, which is much more important. In order for the Tet Offensive to be successful from the point of view of the communist side militarily, they'd have to take these targets. Now, they took none of these targets, with the exception of Hue, as I said earlier, for about 3 weeks.
Okay, well, let's move on to Hue, if we may.
Yes.
As you know, in the PBS series, and I'd like you to mention the PBS series in your
yes.
introductory remark, PBS series, a person comes on and tries to justify the Hue massacres as a spontaneous reaction of the populace.
Yes.
And in talking to me, you said this is something like having the executioner
yes.
speaking about his own crime. And
yes.
You described this person, he'd been a student, he was the head of the infiltration network, and so on.
Yes.
So let's move on to the Hue
yes.
massacre and say something about the PBS presentation.
Yes.
And then lead on with from there.
Okay. Now, in the PBS presentation of the Tet Offensive.
Well, let me cut that just for a little cough
repeat.
At the beginning.
Okay.
Yes. Relax.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the PBS series about the Tet Offensive, then the Hue massacre was, in fact, mentioned, and one Vietnamese witness was even interviewed. The only thing is that right after that witness, immediately a person by the name of Hoang Phu Ngoc Tuong.
Why don't we just start over again and leave out the witness, just get right to Mr. Hoang Phu, okay?
Okay, okay. In the PBS series about the Tet Offensive, the massacre in Hue was mentioned, but the PBS made sure that we got also the communist versions of that massacre, and they put on Hoang Phu Ngoc Tuong to explain about what happened in Hue. Now, Hoang Phu Ngoc Tuong, who was not at all identified in the series as being the head of the infiltration network of the communists at the University of Hue. He, in fact, was the Robespierre, sort of that period in Hue. And he was in charge of ordering all these executions, about 4,000 people, as it was discovered later. And now you let the man speak about what happened, then it's about equivalent to letting the executioner talking about his own crime, getting Himmler to talk about the concentration camps. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Okay, well, can we approach this one more time, but in a very
yes.
brief, concentrated
okay.
way?
Mm-hmm.
And I would, would you start off stressing that he had been a student at the University of Hue, that he was the head of the infiltration network, and then lead up to the fact that he oversaw the, in some capacity, the massacre, and then was asked to comment on it. And your reference to Himmler, I think, is a good one.
Okay.
But in a short response.
Okay. Well, the PBS series, in the presentation of the Hue massacre, put Hoàng Phủ Ngọc Tường on the screen to explain about what happened in Hue during that time. Now, Hoàng Phủ Ngọc Tường was the head of the Communist Infiltration Network among the student population in Hue, at the Hue University. He was, in fact, the one running the so-called revolutionary government in Hue during the 3 weeks that the communists were there. He was probably the one to order the execution of these at least 4,000 people that we discovered later in mass graves. Now, years later, he's allowed to explain about what happened in Hue. Now, it's about equivalent to Himmler talking about a concentration camp.
Okay, fine. Now, could we move on? And sticking with the Hue massacre,
yes.
Could you just, in your own words, describe what happened? The people were removed from the city, taken from their homes, and taken out south and west of the city, I guess as it was. And just describe in a narrative fashion what happened. What was the Hue massacre?
Okay. The Hue massacre, as it is reconstructed, happens in this way. At first, they came into town, and they tried to spot the so-called reactionaries, quote-unquote. This means anybody who is educated, the teachers, people who talk against them. For instance, there was an old man, Wu Tengming, famous for his flute playing in Geneva at the time of the Geneva Agreement. He went back to Hue and lived in his old age. But when the communists came into town, he spoke very strongly against Ho Chi Minh. Immediately he was arrested and jailed. But when the communists had to decide to pull out of town because of the counterattack, then at first they took these people along. And but since 4,000 people is quite a number to take care of, so immediately they realized that by the time they reached the outskirts of Hue, they'd have to get rid of these people somehow. So they just shot them while they were having their hands tied in the bags, and then put them in these mass graves that right on the outskirts of town. And there's about two major areas out of which people eventually dug out about 4,000 corpses. Yeah.
Okay, could you describe the Hue massacre again, but very
succinct.
Yeah, succinct.
Okay.
Let me stop you, Teddy.
We got a couple of hits real bad on that one, but if he's gonna do it again.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I heard the.
Okay.
Let's just try briefly, and I would leave out the anecdote about the flute player.
Yes. Okay.
And just kind of the more you could identify the types of people, the Catholic priest, the school teacher, the this sort of thing. I think.
Yes.
Giving the diversity of the people who were taken out.
Yes. Okay. The Hue massacre was a result of the decision by the communists to pull out of town because of the counterattack by the Vietnamese Marine and the American Marines. So when they pulled out of town, they had wanted to take along these 4,000 people. And that includes teachers, priests, women, old men, children, because later on we formed the list and we found hundreds of children in there. Because they were arrested, because they were suspected of working for the Vietnamese government or something like that, and they were dragged out of town. Well, I want to repeat it because it's such a
okay.
Yeah, succinctly.
That's different types of
Okay. While the communists were in Hue, they arrested thousands of people, among them teachers, priests, old men, women, even children. And when they decided to pull out of town because of the counterattack by the Vietnamese Marine and the American Marines, then first they took these people along. But 4,000 people is a lot of people to take along with a retreating army. So right after they got to the outskirts of this city, they decided to kill them all. So they shot them, with many of them still having their hands tied behind their backs or in a string, tying one person to another. And then they just bury them in very shallow graves. In fact, it took almost no time for people to discover those graves, because with the rain in Hue, it rains poor very much, then immediately these corpses got exposed and the smells and everything. So people came and discovered eventually over 4,000 people and with names and identification and so on them. So we knew exactly who those people were.
Okay, could you say something about the uncovering of the graves after the battle? Yeah. Just describe your memory of what happened and so on. I have footage of this, and I will put your words with the footage. Just a second.
Yeah.
I think this happened last time. We had a fire truck going by. But I'm very pleased with what we've covered, Mr. Beck, and I won't keep you much longer.
Well, we'll let it go, and then we do it. Yeah.
Okay, why don't we try to just say something about what happened after the battle was over, the dust settled, and started looking for the graves, and if you could say something about what was discovered.
Yes. Well, soon after the retaking of Hue, then people started wondering where their loved one went. And some people may be in hiding and return home. Others were known to have been captured by the communists, and people wonder where they went. Then pretty soon rumors had it that the communists had first took these people along with them. And so they tried to follow that track, trying to find these people. And because of the rain in particular, and because these mass graves were under very shallow sand cover, by itself, for instance, is basically sand. So the rain sort of washed right away off the sand, and these corpses were discovered here and there, and then their smells start, exhuming. And that's how people discover those mass graves. And once the word is out, then the whole city is turned out to these mass graves trying to find their loved one. And of course, it was a fantastic scene, because it's people by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, crying over their loved one when they find them, either through identity cards or features like glasses or clothing and things like that, that they knew they belonged to their loved one. And it was an unbelievable tragedy.
Okay, could we start at the point where you said that the whole city turned out looking for this, and kind of repeat what you said earlier?
Yeah, okay. Well, when when these mass graves were discovered, as soon as the information gets back into the cities, then people would rush out by the thousands and later on tens of thousands trying to look for their loved ones. And the way that they go and look for, when it's a case of decomposed bodies, then you have to go by the clothing, by the shoes, by the glasses, by the identity cards and things like that. And as soon as you discover a loved one, then of course the whole family would be crying desperately and things like that. So it was an unbelievable sight to have these tens of thousands of people clamoring during the day and well into the night, because it took several days before that whole thing was over, and then you could identify your own loved ones.
I would like to ask you one final question, and it would be this. In terms of public information and the perception of foreign policy, have we learned anything from the Tet Offensive and from the Vietnam experience with media reporting the foreign policy one way and then the diplomats seeing it another way? Is there a lesson that can be applied today?
Clearly. I'd say that the first...
Could you start and say if there's a lesson from the Tet Offensive?
Okay. If there's a lesson from the Tet Offensive, I would say that the first one would be that we have to restrain our penchant for the instantaneous. Somehow it seems that the Western press in particular, and American press also, has this particular liking for the immediate without having time to look into the background of it or look at the broad pictures, so that instead of 72 points of attacks by the communists during the Tet Offensive, there's only one point that got all the attention practically at the American embassy. And then the background of it, which takes time to absorb, for instance, the fact that practically the whole military infrastructure of the National Liberation Front, that is the South Vietnamese communists, as contrasted to the North Vietnamese army, then that whole South Vietnamese military complex was eliminated as a result of the Tet Offensive. So no matter what criterions you use, that's about the greatest defeat that you can get. That is, you are wiped out as an army.
Okay, yes. And I'm hearing some noise in the background, yeah. So we might want to go with this lesson.
Yes.
And maybe against. What you want to do is, if you would drop in the word television, I think it was implied by what you were saying.
Yes.
The instantaneous, the dramatic picture, yes. As opposed to the bigger story, which was the destruction of the NLF, and that never got across. What people were doing is they were watching fires and embarrassed embassy defense force and so on.
Yeah.
So if we could say if there's a lesson from the Tet Offensive. Yeah.
Okay, if there's a lesson from the state, if there's a lesson from the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, as far as the media is concerned, I should say that we will have to learn to stay away from that penchant from the instantaneous, from the visual, which is the 40s of television as a media in the United States. Now, a war in Vietnam happens, like the Tet Offensive, at least 72 points of attacks by the communists all over the country pretty much the same day. And yet somehow only one part of that story is covered, which is the attack on the American embassy. Then the what happens afterwards is totally ignored. For instance, the complete destruction of the NLF as a military force in South Vietnam. After 1968, then you look at the order of battles and all these kind of things, you only see North Vietnamese units. You don't see any more NLF units there. And that's why after 1968, you could start the pacification campaign, which went all very, very well until the Paris Agreement.
Okay, in your own words, could you state that in some way the Tet Offensive was a military disaster for the NLF, but a psychological victory for them in the United States. And
yeah.
So
you're
just
kind of
fill in that picture a little bit.
Yes. Well, the Tet Offensive clearly was disastrous for the NLF, which totally changed the nature of the war. As I said, afterwards, it's only the NLF, it's only the North Vietnamese Army.
Let me start over.
Yeah, okay. The Tet Offensive as a military operation was a total disaster for the NLF. Not only their military structures was destroyed, but even their infiltration structure in Saigon and places like that were uncovered because of the Tet Offensive. And that's why we could eliminate those and then start the pacification campaigns afterwards. Nonetheless, in the American press and among American public opinion, that it was considered to be a great victory for them. It's a political victory because it brought down the downfall of one American president. It turns many, many people against the war and did not allow for the prosecution of the war, which in essence we had won by then.
Okay. Yes. Is there something that you would like to say on any of these topics that maybe we didn't cover, or that you'd like to touch on one last time?
Let me see. I guess.
Yeah, we've covered a lot.
New scene, and for what new purpose, and what are the factors behind the scenes?